if you're unfamiliar with VCs, the chances that you get a term sheet for MVC is almost zero. Capital has responsibility, and the fiduciary responsibility on the provider of capital is that he has to watch it all the way to make sure that that money is doing what it needs to do.
A few weeks ago, Nigerian VC firm We Capital announced the launch of its second fund, the We Capital Mentors Fund. Interestingly, one of their LPs included Tosin Eniolorunda, CEO of Nigerian fintech startup Team Apt, and one of the firm's early investments. In this episode of Equity Merchants, I speak with Oluo Yintan, the firm's managing partner, to learn more about the business of venture capital and how startups can attract more investors. But before we get in, let's take a message from the TechPoint Africa business team.
Hi, I'm Abisola Adenoga, the head of business at TechPoint Africa. Are you an early stage startup looking for brand awareness for your organization? You're in search of potential investors and product engagement? Leverage TechPoint Africa's extensive network of startups, tech enthusiasts, investors, and executives on the African continent and beyond to elevate your brand and business. For inquiries, please send us an email to business@techpoint.africa or click on the link in the description. Together, let's take your business to the next level.
Hello, Lou. Welcome to Equity Merchants. I usually start off on a personal note or a semi-personal note. So everyone knows you're a VC, but apart from being a VC, who is Olu?
That's a very good question, because I think I would like to tell myself that I like to maintain all the other parts of me outside being a venture investor. Of course, you know that a venture investor is a full-time role that takes a lot of your personality. First things, I think I'll describe them in bullet points. I think I also have a left brain side of me, right? I have an affinity for art, either it's physical art, music. I play two musical instruments myself. I'm a field footballer.
What instruments are they?
I play the bass guitar and the drums.
Okay.
Right. I'm a failed footballer. I wanted to be a professional footballer when I was younger. I had a partial scholarship to do it in the UK, of course. My African dad said no. And I know there are clips of me floating across the internet where I'm playing at the five-a-side on Wednesdays and on Saturdays. I take it very religiously. So in case venture fails, maybe I'll go and play in Sunday League or Old People's League. Those two are me. I also enjoy spending some time with friends, family. People know that I can be a social butterfly if I like you or if I feel comfortable in that space. So I guess those are the areas of me that some people know. Some people don't even know I'm a venture investor, for example. And I try to keep that balance in the different parts of my life, and none takes from the other.
Okay, it's good to know that you actually have a life outside venture capital. So that's interesting. All right, so in 2018, you left your job to start We Capital. So the first time I saw the name We Capital, I was like, okay, what language is this? And it was later I discovered that we is actually, you're borrowing from the French word to basically say yes capital.
Correct.
For people who don't understand French. So how has the experience been? This is about 3 or 4 years since you decided to strike out on your own. So yeah. What has the experience been like?
You know, they say hindsight is vision 2020, right? When you look back, you want to say, yeah. Oh yes, I could have done this. I knew it was going to turn out like this, but that wasn't really it. So it's been, we launched We Capital in January 2019. So yeah, it's almost 4 years now. It's gone by like 3 months because of the amount of pressure and just the amount of possible failures you can achieve every day, right? I would say being a venture capital investor is not something for the faint-hearted, especially if you're not leaving your role at maybe Sequoia or A16Z, where you know they give you a 20% anchor check and tell you go into the world and prosper. but you're not leaving after 20 years in Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley. When you approach venture capital as being a first-time fund manager, emerging manager, right, and again, investing in Africa, you almost triple your risk, your chances of failure, right? And so it's very, very difficult. Mm. That's what I would say. But it's not impossible, as you can see from how we're just striving to move along day by day. So what I really think is, it's actually entrepreneurship, especially if you're starting a venture capital fund from scratch. It's entrepreneurship on steroids, because succeeding or failing to launch, especially for the first fund, is almost a binary thing, because you usually have a certain amount of capital you want to get in the door before you can even make an economically viable fund or start to invest. And so it's a really challenging endeavor, just to put it simply for you. It's a really challenging endeavor, and it's also very, very mentally draining, just realizing, am I going to succeed or am I going to fail at every point in time? And, you know, people put investors on this pedestal that we really don't belong. And so it's almost like your failure is a lot more, is under the magnifying glass. And so I would say it's really tough, but if you approach it like you have no other choice, I think you succeed.
Mm. Interesting. So you just mentioned that people put investors on this pedestal, and for a lot of people, they just see the fundraisers on TechPoint, TechCrunch, TechAbout. They don't exactly understand how this happens. So I don't know, for many Africans, VC is like a very, very, let's say, novel. It's like a novel concept, because the traditional forms of financing were usually from banks or maybe loans from family and friends. But now you have people who are willing to give you money without you putting up collateral. So can you just give us like a crash course on what venture capital is and how do VCs make their money?
So every time I would like you to associate the word venture with adventure. Right, you see that adrenaline rush you get when you hear adventure. It means you're going into the unknown, right? You don't know what you're going to find. Sometimes the objectives are transient and fluid, right? Or what you're going to come back with, you just don't know. And the reason why venture capital should give anyone that adrenaline buzz is because venture capital is the asset class. The asset class, when I say, is the financing type that backs entrepreneurs going on adventures. Right? As you said, for most other traditional types of finance, you need a lot more certainty on what you're going to do, how you're going to achieve it, what the objectives are, what the deliverables are. Venture capital needs it needs a very different kind of thinking. And I can tell you this because I started my career in commercial banking, doing loans to traditional small businesses and those kind of things, right? Where you run cash flow models and you're almost certain. And if it doesn't come out, someone has failed. Venture capital is that asset class, is that financing vehicle that backs entrepreneurs or founders that are trying to build something where there's so many unknown quantities. And this is why venture capital is one of the asset classes where people must be comfortable with risk. So what you do as a venture capitalist is that you are that provider of finance, provider of resources, provider of capital to the lady or the guy who's building something that is bold, that the objectives or the outcomes are not really known, right? But they can describe it, they can sell you a dream, and you say, we will back you, right? Just take some of the most innovative companies that have been built around the world, right? Take, for example, Airbnb. Take, for example, Uber, right? When people were going to build companies like Uber, if you had told someone that I would call a stranger and he would let me sit in his car without the fear of getting kidnapped or killed, it sounded crazy, right? So when Travis Kalanick went around and telling people, I'm trying to build Uber Taxi, you almost have to be crazy to back that. If he came to you and said, I'm starting this taxi company, like the one down the street or like the other one down the other street, right? It makes sense. You're like, okay, show me your financial projections. How do you show financial projections for a company that doesn't exist, a concept that's new, a concept that has never been done before, right? But VCs backed this company. It wasn't even really a company yet, right? It was a dream. It was an idea to revolutionize how people move around.
Yeah.
And it's venture capital that lends itself to backing this kind of things. And so what we do is that we back big and bold ideas, right? Support the founders of those companies and eventually hope that it works out in the magnitude that we've expected. A majority of companies in that big and bold phase would fail, which is normal, right? Thomas Edison tried it many times before he was able to succeed. And so when you're pushing the edge of human endeavor, of innovation, there's bound to be a lot of failure, but it depends on how you see that failure. If you see that failure as a chance to just try again, that's important. And that's how VCs, we look at capital. The flip side is when it goes well, it goes very well. And this is where the financial returns for venture capitalists come in. And as I always say, venture capitalists were wrong most of the time, right? But a good investor just needs to be right a lot more than others. And that's really how VC is as an asset class. This is just describing it metaphorically. So when you get down to the business of venture capital, basically what we do is that we make bets that are modeled into a portfolio, right? We understand that the chances of risk, chances of failure are high. And so we model a portfolio based on how we perceive the risks to see how we can most distribute our chances of success. So that every time there's a failure or there's a company that doesn't do as well as we expected, there's another one that can basically cover for the losses of that and still return decent returns to our investors. And so what venture capitalists basically do is go out to institutions, go out to high net worths, go out to fund management companies, just go out to places where capital is surplus, right? Pull that capital together and invest in places where capital is not surplus, right? Especially tech and tech-enabled businesses. And a good investor is more likely to get multiple times the money they've invested in all those businesses in an aggregate, right? And then they return that money to the investors they took the money from, and they take a piece of it, which is what we usually call carried interest, right? Carried interest or performance fees, those kind of things. And that's basically what venture capital is. That's the model.
All right. That's like a very brief explanation of what VCs do and how they work. So you mentioned earlier that I should associate venture with adventure. And there's this,
correct,
well, let's say, recurring debate between VCs and founders. And it's almost like founders, or some founders, feel, okay, you guys are just giving us the money. You're the ones doing the groundwork, building businesses, you know, and VCs are like, okay, without us, you don't even get the money to be able to build this business. So what's your take on this debate, and how can we achieve a balance? Because in some way, every side is correct. So how do we achieve a balance with this?
I think there's already a balance, right? There's just not a balance on Twitter or in the public space. There's a balance and each person realizes what they bring to the table, right? And that's why venture capital has been around for maybe close to 100 years now. And it's been a successful asset class because people realize that it takes two to tango, right? To build every successful business, you a lot of times need capital, and of course you need to put in the work, right? So we come to this table where founders say, I'll put in the work, and the VCs say, I will bring the capital. I think the one thing that is not clear to a lot of people is that VCs mostly don't even own that money, right? They try to create this dynamic where VCs are the rich, big, bad wolves, and founders are the ones looking for the money, right? It's not the thing. A lot of VCs are founders themselves, but it's just that what they trade in is stock of companies and cash that they raise from investors. And I will tell you, just the way people go around with their pitch decks or pitch hundreds of investors every time, this is what I do as a VC.
Yeah.
Right? So exactly the way the founder sits in front of us and tries to pitch, this is how I go around the world, sleeping in dingy places, just to pitch investors for the founders. So once we realize that we're on the same page and we're on the same side, it becomes easier, right? Because a VC's incentive, again, is that you succeed, right? That money doesn't belong to him. That money has a purpose, it has a responsibility, it needs to be returned. And a lot of times when there is a disconnect between a founder and a VC, it's usually because the VC doesn't feel that while I'm meeting this founder's objectives, mine are going to be met, right? And usually this is the disconnect. So I don't see us on two different sides. And when I'm speaking for good VCs who have founders' interests at heart. I'm not talking about vulture capitals, right? I'm talking about good VCs. VCs who are doing it the way it should be done. We're on the same side. But remember, for every equation, when both of you are on a team, you need both to win. What you see a lot of times is one party can be more focused on what they want and forgetting what makes it worthwhile for the other party. And this is usually where conflict comes in, not just in venture, but in everything else. In marriage, in friendships, people say, you're not doing this for me. I want you to do more for me. I want you to do more for me. But this person doesn't look like. Why is this person doing it for me? What's in it for them? The moment you can always answer the question, what's in it for this other person? It makes the world a better place, right? And then it creates that synergy where we're working together to achieve common goals. What do we want to do? We want to build a successful company. We want to generate a lot of value. We want to make impact. And we want to all return money to our investors. So we all go away better than we came in. And so when it looks like only one person is going to benefit from that, then you start to see discontent and you start to see conflict. So I don't see it that way. I think we're on the same side, trying to achieve the same thing, trying to create value.
Okay. So we capital or US capital, founders have to pitch a lot of VCs in order for them to get the funds that they need. So what are the tips you give to a founder so that they get past that first stage where you're submitting your pitch deck or sharing your pitch deck with a VC? So what are the tips you'd give to a founder to ensure that their pitch deck doesn't just get lost in the, numerous decks that a VC gets? So what tips would you give a founder?
The thing about VC is that it imitates life a lot. And as I just told you, right? About give and takes. So first thing I would like to send out there is that they call us VCs, but as a founder, I think I pitch investors averagely more than the average founder, right? I'm with my pitch deck pitching investors a lot more than an average founder. And apart from that, it's about 8 to 10 times more difficult to raise money as a VC than as a founder, because you don't have FOMO on your side and you're selling a homogeneous product, right? It's not an opportunity that's going to disappear tomorrow. So you have to convince your own investors beyond reasonable doubt that this is the time, even though they could do it next year, that this is the time, this is the right product, which is the same. VC is VC is VC. Mm-hmm. And you are the right person, right? And so I'll put it in my shoes. Yeah. What do I do to attract capital to We Capital, right? When we go out. Most important thing, as I said before, is that capital finance is a game of incentives, right? We all want to win. What's my own investor's incentive? Is that he wants to invest his money in maybe a company or a fund that's going to generate alpha returns for him, right? Second thing, some types of investors want a company or a fund that is going to do well and do good. Basically, while they're making money, make the world a better place, right? Some others are looking for safety of their money, right? They just want to diversify into asset classes. So what I do as the founder of WeCapital is that I speak to those incentives, right? I'm putting myself in their shoes. And this is the same thing that a traditional tech founder needs to do. All we do in VC is raise money and look for the best places to put money. So basically about half or 70% of a VC's time, he's actually looking for founders. Founders are the middle of our universe. Without founders, we have no industry, right? And so once you first realize that VCs are looking for founders just as much or almost as much as founders are looking for VCs, you cross the first barrier to understand that this is a natural attraction. Because if I go a whole year without finding a brilliant founder to back, then I might have no job. So I'm constantly looking for founders who are building brilliant, bold ideas. The question is, are you that founder? Right? And this is where a lot of people stumble. As I told you before, my incentive is to return 80% of the gains that we make and keep 20% for myself and my team. So every time, question is, are you that founder that will help me achieve this goal? Right? And this is why a lot of times you have to position yourself in that way. World over, opportunities are more plentiful than capital. And that's why it looks like there's an imbalance, right? Money is scarce. We all know that. But the thing about it is that money is also looking for opportunities. So the first thing I would say of founders finding VCs is think about this person's incentive. Not all VCs have the same incentive. Some are impact funds, some are pseudo philanthropies, some are family offices who are just looking for strategic investments. Some are corporate VCs who are looking for companies they can acquire down the line. They're not really looking for capital appreciation as such, right? So when you understand an investor's incentives, that's the first thing. The second thing is that because capital is scarcer than founders or opportunities or companies, you need to find a way to put yourself on top of the pile, right? It's just like looking for a job. If you're looking for a job in McKinsey, BCG, or Bain today, you don't go to their website, toss your resume there, even sometimes maybe without a cover letter, and sit at home and wait for someone to call you. It's never going to happen, because for every role that opens up, there may be 6,000 applicants. So if you are a proactive thinker, you should realize that that's not enough. What else can I do? Some go and write a cover letter and say, I realize you guys are trying to get into petrochemical consulting. That's your new found challenge in Indonesia. I have 6 years experience in petrochemical consulting, right? I'm the guy for you. You see what you've intentionally done. You've aligned both incentives. And if your chances are 1 out of 6,000 before, it's probably dropped to 1 to 1,000. All right? You've written that beautiful cover letter. Yeah. You've dropped it in there. Nothing happens. What next do you do? You go and look for the partner that's in charge of Indonesia. This is just regular problem solving. Right? And say, hey, if it's a message on LinkedIn, and say, hey, I understand you guys have a need for this and this and this in Indonesia, petrochemicals. This is my experience. This is why I'm a good fit for McKinsey. And you shoot that to maybe 6 or 7 of their partners. Your chances of being called for an interview have again dropped from 1 over 1,000 to maybe 1 over 200, right? This is life. We shouldn't expect venture capital to imitate anything different, right? And then when you get to 1 over 200, there's a chance that a partner sees it. But he says, this is not my priority right now. I have this multi-million dollar deal that is about to close. I can't respond now, but I'll come back to you. That's not the right thing, by the way, but it's life. It happens. Do you come back in 2 weeks and say, hey, I shot you an email on this. I really think I'm the guy for you. This is how I can help you, not this is how you can help me. Right? Again, all centered around incentives. This is how I can help you. I can take that your petrochemical business in Indonesia from 1 million to a $30 million business. Right? This is what I've done before. Yeah. This is my portfolio work I've done before. If you're the guy for it. If not, you can tell them, I have been spending 20 hours a week reading on petrochemicals. This is now my new passion. The moment you do that, it sets you apart. Remember that VCs are always looking for the next big opportunity. But like everyone else, we only have 24 hours a day. And so you help us. If you have a strong company, you help a VC by bringing it up to his line of sight or her line of sight. And there are many different ways to do this. But again, a lot of good VCs, like our firm, we go through every single inbound we receive. There are two people dedicated on the team that just look at inbounds. For example, the announcement of our first close of our second fund dropped about 2 days ago, and we've been inundated with deal flow, just how we like it. And I was talking to one of the analysts this morning, and he told me our deal flow has 5x'd. Why does he know that? Because he's seen everything, right? A lot of times, people have seen things that you think they haven't seen. It just hasn't aligned with their incentives. It's just not there yet. Either in terms of quality of the company or the quality of the propositioning, or it just doesn't fit into their thesis. So doing a lot of research and figuring out what this person is looking for or what this firm is looking for might actually help you to either hit the bullseye either vertically or horizontally, right? And so that's, again, one of the really important things that founders can do to get there. But truthfully, I would not consider, if I, as a fund, I would not go to pages or websites or fund of funds and just keep dropping my deck. I could do it as a starting strategy, but if I expect that that's going to raise me millions of dollars for my fund, I'm probably not being realistic enough. And this also goes for the people who are building tech companies. If the provider of the capital going to drop your deck is not enough, right? You need to find ways to increase your chances of getting seen. And that being said, a lot of times we see these things. But just because VCs see almost everything, they see your competitors, a lot of times it's just not there yet. Sometimes the founders are not ready yet, right? We try to send feedback as much as we can. But remember, we only have 24 hours, right? And we have bills to pay. And so a lot of times it's that dance, eventually gets there. One day I actually have a reservoir of some first contacts and companies that are now currently in our portfolio. Some first contacts was just a simple message on LinkedIn, right? That has ended up becoming a company in our portfolio. So VCs do see these things, right? But a lot of times, two people just have to do the work.
Okay. So I think you've given like a very, very good response, and this has been, it's basically a masterclass on raising money from VCs and also actually getting what you want in life. So what's like the most innovative pitch that a founder has made to you?
For someone who seeds about 2,000 companies every year, I'm not sure I do remember, truthfully. Let me see. I'm not sure I do remember. But also, I want to bust a myth. Innovative pitches are great, right? And this is why I think pitch competitions that allow the founders less than 10 minutes are a waste of time. right? Because there's a lot of work that goes on between the pitch and the check. There's so much work. So an innovative pitch might at best do what I explained initially, get the provider of capital to listen, right? But that's where it ends.
Yeah.
All the work that goes in into qualifying the investment, to negotiating, to doing due diligence, this is where the meat is. And so I think founders spend sometimes a suboptimal amount of time focusing on a pitch deck, right? It's almost what we call like a negative screen in impact investing. If your pitch deck is shitty, you reduce your chances, right? But it doesn't necessarily improve your chances by your pitch deck being amazing, right? The important thing is the business. And good VCs invest behind businesses, right? Not a founder's ability to design a PowerPoint slide, right? If it is shitty, then it might tell me something about you. But if you can present the information that needs to be presented in a legible, clean way, and you do your work of getting it to the eyesight of the person who needs to provide you capital, I think you've done a lot. The important thing is that the information they need to be attracted enough to dig deeper is what your pitch deck needs to do, right? A lot of times, maybe if we took about 5 weeks to do a deal, we've not gone back to the pitch deck since after week one. Right? In fact, after the first conversation, the pitch deck almost takes a back seat. And then it's about all the other things that have to do with the business. Anybody can make a pitch deck. Right? And then you want to qualify all the things you've seen or the founder has made you to think about or believe in the pitch deck. Now it's real business, right? As I say, we don't write checks on vibes and inshallah. We do the work. And so an innovative pitch is great to get someone to listen, but I think a business case is a lot more important, right? So when you meet a VC, you probably want to talk numbers, but because you remember, his incentive is the numbers. Numbers of how big this can get, how fast you can grow, how big this market is, the opportunity. Remember, when he's thinking of his 20%. So if you make the 100% big enough, you will probably get them to listen.
Okay, a lot of founders, they are like very unfamiliar with VC. They've probably not raised money from VCs before. So what are some of the terms that they should be looking out for when they get a term sheet? What are some clauses, some terms that they should be watching out for when they get a term sheet from a VC?
Okay, great. The first ironic thing is that if you're unfamiliar with VCs, the chances that you get a term sheet for MVC is almost zero, right? So let's start from there. What usually happens is that it's kind of readiness, right? It's like, again, wanting to take a job at a top consulting company with almost no consulting experience or no informal learning of like case interviews, frameworks, right? You're almost not qualified for the job, right? So if you're this unfamiliar with a set of people who you think hold the capital you need to unlock the next level of your business, high chances are that you're not ready. And this is why before people approach VCs, there's usually some validation in friends and family rounds, right? Angel rounds, sometimes mentor rounds, right? And the truth is, before you start seeing terms in a term sheet, especially the more simple ones, you probably know what this game is about before you get a term sheet. Because while preparing yourself for capital raising, it doesn't say a lot about you. It doesn't say great things about you as a founder not to have gone out of your way to familiarize yourself with what the workings of this type of capital you're about to take are. Right? It doesn't flatter you as a founder, right? It's just like me saying I want to go and raise money from LPs. And some type of terms that LPs put in term sheets, the most simple ones, I don't know it. The question you would ask is, did you miss your way here? Did you prepare yourself? Are you really ready? Right? Of course, there are high-level terms that are complex, and sometimes you need a lawyer to maybe break it down or an experienced investor, and that's fine. But usually, even when we hire, we've hired people who are not from traditional VC spaces. But when you set yourself and say you want to break into VC, which I guess is another topic we will cover later on, the question is going to be asked, even while you're not in VC, what have you done by yourself to hit the ground running on day one? Right? If you have to be asking those questions after you receive a term sheet, chances are you will never receive a term sheet. That's the first thing. So YouTube is your friend. Y Combinator videos are your friend. There's so much free resources on the internet. Even starting from reading TechPoint and Tech Cabal and TechCrunch every other day. You need to prepare yourself mentally, right? You would notice that the education starts from there so that when opportunity comes, it meets you prepared, right? That's the first thing. The second thing I would just say is there are a few things that are really fundamental to a term sheet when a venture capitalist gives a founder a term sheet. Some of these are pretty known in the industry now. Some of them are a little more complex. And this is why I really don't think you should be closing the deal without having a lawyer look at it. Unless it's maybe a Y Combinator safe and you have done your homework. If it's not one of those, maybe a safe or a Techstars, I think it's the KISS agreement or a 500 Startups. If you're not doing one of those standard deals, I think you should talk to a lawyer, right? But some of the very simple things just revolve around economics, which has to do with how money and resources is shared and control, right, of the company. The moment you first thing you need to realize is that the moment you take outside money, you're going to give up one of these or both to a certain extent. And you need to be comfortable with that as a founder. If not, build the company with your own money. And then you can keep all that. Because I see that dichotomy of ideas where you want to take someone else's money, but you still want to keep all your ownership and all the control. It doesn't work like that. Because capital has responsibility. And the fiduciary responsibility on the provider of capital is that he has to watch it all the way to make sure that that money is doing what it needs to do, right? And they also have to have a reward for taking that risk on you. So a lot of times, the common things you see in term sheets are around economics and control of the company. Some things around economics, especially at least from the sense of the word you can tell, is what piece or what percentage of ownership is this person now going to have, this investor, now going to have in your company? And that usually has to do with the valuation, right? An easy way of doing it is dividing the valuation by the number, by the amount, the valuation of that company, what that company is agreed to be worth by the amount that investor is putting down. That usually gives you the amount of equity that the investor is now going to own. Classes of shares are another bucket of fish. But it's not that complex. But basically, they now own a piece. And you need to treat someone who owns a piece of your company like someone who owns a piece of your company now, right? Because you guys are now, as they say, inside the same trouser, right? Another thing is about who gets what, when. This still has to do with economics, right? Because the hope is that you invest in a company, one day they call you while you're outside protesting for NSAS that, oh, the transaction is done, Paystack has been sold, come and take your fat checks, right? It does happen, but it's not the majority of the time. So the question is, when it doesn't happen like that, who gets what when, right? If the company is sold for less than the amount of capital they've raised, if it's sold for slightly more, but less than what the investor expected, right? If it's sold for a decent amount, who gets what? Who gets to take first, right? And this is where something we call liquidation preferences come in, where it's, we've given you $100,000 to run this company. You ran it well, according to you. You've been earning salary the 3 years you've been running this company. Now you've sold it for $120,000, right? Yes, I only own 10% of that company. But is it fair for me to go home with $12,000 when I invested $100,000, right? And you still go home with majority of it when I'm the only one who brought cash. And throughout this time, you've been earning salary from the operations of that company, basically taking some of that money. Then it becomes commonsensical approaches where VCs put in some terms to protect the economics, to say, no matter what happens here, even if I don't get money, let me take out what I brought in. If it's sold for anything above this 100,000, it does make sense, right? Because the VC is probably the only one who brought cash, right? So this is where liquidation preferences come in, where people are asking, in case the objective, the outcome is not the objective, what happens at different places, right? That's really important too. And also just built into the liquidation preference is share classes, right? Where investors usually want to take some senior classes of shares, right? To signify the fact that they are the ones who brought the cash into the company, right? So these are usually the things around economics, right? So you want to watch out for what the valuation is, what class of shares, and usually what, if there are any liquidation preferences, right? In your term sheet. On the control side, so that we don't take too much time, what we usually find is that if I put money in the company, either I have the fiduciary responsibilities to my investors to monitor how that is going, or if it's my personal money, I owe it to myself to make sure I'm not blindsided, right? So a lot of times people want some type of control, not controlling stakes of the company, not to become the executive of the company, but to have levers that they can pull that incentivizes the founder to do the right thing too, right? Because the truth is that there is a natural tendency of human beings to take advantage of one another. And so this is where control comes in. Sometimes there are provisions in the term sheet where you need recourse to an investor or a provider of capital to do certain things. Maybe spend a certain amount of money, either hire a certain number or hierarchy of people, either make a strategic decision. And this usually shows up either in an advisory board or a board of directors. So a lot of times investors want to take board seats, right? Just to be able to exert some level of oversight and control over what's happening to their money, which I think is just fair. I think the most important thing that also just stating this is that good investors do not seek to run the companies. Any investor who is seeking to either run the company or have ultimate control over the strategic direction of a company, it's probably a bad investor, and you want to stay away from taking money from investors like that. There's a reason why a founder is a founder. If the investor loves that business so much, he might have well just gone to do it by himself, right? And so it's very important to always delineate the role of a founder and the role of an investor, but also create levers and control levers that make everybody's incentives aligned. So being on the board or creating some certain thresholds is very important. And sometimes you see things like bad lever provisions just to make, to incentivize the founder to act in a certain way.
You mentioned earlier something about breaking into venture capital, so let's talk about that. How can someone break into venture capital, especially in Africa? What are like tips that you'd give someone who is looking to get into VC?
It depends on where you're coming from, right? If you're coming from so let me break it down career-wise. Venture capital is a combination of three different skills or career types, right? It's one of equity finance, two consulting, and three sales. Right? Well, some people call marketing voice sales. Excuse me. And so the reason why you need equity finance skills is because of the economics I told you about, I mentioned, right? You need to be able to structure transactions.
Yeah.
Go through with transactions, understand transactions, and basically manage a portfolio that can eventually do alpha returns for your investors. So that's finance business, right? Because you're dealing with money. The second thing is, once that deal is completed, you become a consultant. Right? In fact, even before the deal is completed, you are a consultant when you are doing diligence. And this is usually commercial, market, figuring out where this company stands. You will be using a lot of skills that you find in consulting, right? Competitor analysis, market penetration, pricing, a lot of things that consultants do. You are going to be doing to even figure out, is this the right company to invest in, amongst many others. And then when you're done, you still need those skills. If you are a good VC, you need those skills to continue to support your portfolio company in being able to give them good, valuable advice and being able to see the company from an outsider's perspective inside. Because a lot of times when the founder is there, the founder has a lot of noise in their ears. And so you need to be the person who can stand aside, almost like a consultant, and say, I know you're passionate about this, but maybe you want to go this other direction because it looks like this is where your revenues have been coming from recently. So that's the second one. The third one is sales, right? It's more prevalent when you get higher up in venture capital because capital raising is sales. It's a sales job, right? You build a pipeline, you try to convert. The ones that don't convert, you try to convert them, next funds, etc. But on the lower side, remember, what you're selling is money. And so you need to build a lot of relationships to the kind of people who are going to take that money from you. And unfortunately, the type of people that you're really looking for to take that money from you are just not sitting on the side of the curb waiting for you. A lot of times you have to fight to even get into deals. And this is where your sales skills become relevant. And so once you realize it's a combination of these three skills, you start to prepare yourself, right? You start to prepare yourselves for whichever one that you think you need brushing up on, right? Some people come to VC with strictly financial skills. It's not enough. Some people come into VC and they're standalone consultants. It's not really enough, right? The third one is some people come into VC, they're not likable, right? You don't have to be overly gregarious. They're not likable. They cannot sell dreams. When dreams are being sold to them, they can't understand, right? They want to sit behind a desk and crunch numbers and consult. But you're disconnected from the founder, right? You might end up in VC, but you will not be a good one. And so these three skills are very necessary. Again, remember what I said about trying to get anything in life. You need to create an opportunity for yourself where you can be in the eyesight of the person that can make it happen, right? So you need to do these things by yourself and then do the others of getting the kind of visibility you want. Sometimes it just might be dropping the resume. Sometimes it might be really networking, talking to your friend in VC and saying, hey, can I do something for this fund part-time? Can I be a venture partner? Can I be a scout in a place where it now sets you apart from all the other people who are looking for a role in VC, where the people who can make it happen for you can see your skills, right? And then you can move deeper inside. But one thing that is important is that you do the work of getting into VC before you actually get into VC. When you see someone who is a great investor, right, who has brushed up all the skills and has an affinity for entrepreneurship, that person is ready to be in VC. Now they need to just do the other part. right? What you have more is people chasing the position who have not really prepared themselves. They want to prepare themselves when they get in. Unfortunately, like everything else, if you want to prepare yourself when you get in, you will never get in, right? And so one of the popular questions we ask in the fund when we're interviewing people who are coming from non-VC backgrounds is basically, what are you excited about in this space? What company are you excited about? What trend are you excited about? What vertical are you excited about? What happening are you excited about? Right? Someone who hasn't prepared themselves outside of VC would not have a lot of concrete, tangible things to tell you. And remember, everyone is looking for someone who can come from day one, who has all the interest, all these other things, that they just need the opportunity to supercharge their career, right? And so when you see someone who's hungry, they usually would have done a lot of that work by themselves. They're already living like investors in their head. They're listening to investors that they like. They're helping startups, right? They're following startup gossip. They're having theses in their mind. What made this company fail? What made this company succeed, right? What company would I have invested in if I had the money? When someone comes ready like that, they're ready to break into VC. So the rest they need to do is find the visibility and then plug in.
Okay. So let's wrap up with diversity. So in the African context, diversity is women, getting more women funded, and also getting capital to places that have been previously neglected. So when We Capital announced the close of the 30 million fund, you mentioned that you'd like to do a lot more investments in Francophone Africa and North Africa. So what are some of your efforts to increase the diversity of founders that you invest in?
So I would make a quick distinction between the two things you talked about, just on the level of inclusion, getting different types and backgrounds of people into venture capital, right? Not just women, right? Diversity really isn't just about what gender affiliation you belong to. It's really about diversity of almost everything, right? Thoughts, backgrounds, training, gender, religion, in some places, sexual orientation, right? It's really creating an inclusive workplace where everyone's ideas can benefit the company and can benefit the decision-making process. So I would term that diversity. The second thing you've said about investing, I would term it diversification in terms of portfolio, right? So I would say that the short answer is that we are not focused on diversity, right? We're focused on creating the best outcomes in terms of impact and returns for our investors. But we've also found out that if you create an inclusive and diverse workplace, you'd achieve those number one and two goals more effectively, easier, quicker. And that's why we live by diversity. If you probably saw a picture of our team, you'll see that it's probably gender diverse. It's also race, country, tribe diverse, right? And you want to create an environment like that, both in your firm and in the companies you're investing in, because that kind of diversity usually drives higher quality decision making, right? Because we all have blind spots based on our backgrounds, orientation, and our experiences, right? And so once you can bring in, that's, it's like having a side mirror and a front mirror. They're all mirrors, right? But what they see is different. And once you can increase diversity of thought in your organization, you're more likely to eliminate blind spots and make better decisions. The other thing you talked about was diversification. And diversification is actually, we don't do it because you like it. We do it because it's a financial skill, right? In portfolio management for returning best-in-class returns. What you, as the layman, that you don't put all your eggs in one basket, right? And so what you usually want to do is to create a situation where if one basket falls, your fund hasn't fallen, right? You want to create a lot of basket that even if one basket falls, which is bound to happen, you can still return top-tier returns. And this is why you usually want to look for investment targets in either geographies, verticals, or just buckets that make the risks unrelated, right? Where it's non-cyclical, where a drop in the currency of Naira doesn't affect the drop in the currency of the Rand, right? And that way, if your investments in maybe South Africa are not doing as well, you're sure that all the other investments that you have around the continent will be able to make up for that, or at least still keep your returns solid. And that's the reason why we want to invest more. We already have investments in about 9 countries in Africa today. We have in Nigeria, we have in Kenya, Ghana, South Africa, Mauritius, Zimbabwe, Senegal, Egypt. I don't know if I'm forgetting any, but at every point in time, we look for the best investable company on the continent, and we go after that company to not just put capital, but put our resources to help them succeed and help them make impact. And I guess diversification of our portfolio is just a byproduct of backing the best founder per time. So that's how we look at both diversity and diversification at the fund.
Perhaps some other time you have a lot more time to like talk about a lot of other topics in venture capital. So
yes, and then I'll send you my rate card. Okay, perfect. Thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining me today on the podcast. But before we go, a few things. Please share and like this episode. You can also catch up with previous episodes at Equity Merchants Show.